Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
You want signs of economic life? We've got signs of economic life. Just today, almost $11 billion in corporate deals got made. Wall Street looking for love in mergers and acquisitions. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Gather.com, the social network where people can make new friends who share their interests. People talking about today's news at news.gather.com. And by Monsanto, creating hybrid and biotech seeds designed to increase crop yields without increasing demands on natural resources. More at producemoreconservemore.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you here on this Monday, everybody. It is the 28th of September today. You know how we're always saying a pickup in consumer spending is a good indicator that things are getting better economy-wise? The same holds true for corporations. When they are more confident, they tend to spend more. Xerox, the document company, and the healthcare conglomerate Abbott Laboratories are clearly feeling pretty good. Today, they opened their wallets and shelled out a combined $11 billion to expand their opportunities. You think back over the past couple of weeks, and we're up to about a half a dozen or so high-profile deals. Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon has more now on what's behind the pickups and mergers and what we might learn from it.
Mom always told me that money is burning a hole in your pocket, which may explain why I didn't grow up to be a CEO. These days, though, even bosses who've been stuffing their corporate pockets with cash reserves are under increasing pressure to spend it to stay out in front of the competition. Up to now, they've socked away a record $700 billion plus, according to Standard & Poor's, making up for lost profits by cutting costs.
Cost-cutting is only part of the equation.
Suzanne Stevens is a senior editor at The Deal. She says now things seem to be improving. That old business axiom is kicking in again. You've got to spend money to make money.
You've also got to see sales increase at some point. And certainly for public companies, I mean, they're all about growth. And one of the main levers they have to achieve that is through M&A.
Their renewed confidence in spending that money may bode well for the economic future. That's how Fred Dixon sees it. He's chief market strategist for D.A. Davidson & Company.
Possibly the worst days of the credit crisis are really behind us, and companies at this point are moving away from hoarding cash and now thinking opportunistically about expanding their business.
The Deal's Suzanne Stevens says it helps that businesses are finding it a little easier to bolster their own spending money with cheaper credit, but she remains cautious.
There is still a lot of fear out there in the market. I mean, I've interviewed dozens of bankers and M&A lawyers who will tell you that, yeah, credit is a problem. It's certainly holding down the level of M&A. But fear and pricing continue to be an issue. You know, boards are much more cautious.
After what we've been through, though, Stevens points out the extra care behind these deals might actually encourage the banks to start lending a little more freely. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Given the international headlines, both economic and political, it's hard to argue that foreign news is becoming less important. Thing is, though, that newsrooms are cutting foreign coverage because it's so expensive. Today, CBS announced it has found a workaround. The Tiffany Network is looking to save some cash by partnering with a website called Global Post. It provides a worldwide network of reporters for a fee, of course, and perhaps is a way that news organizations can expand their foreign coverage instead of cutting it. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports now from New York.
Global Post launched in January. It gets about 400,000 visitors a month. It also offers its articles to about 25 news organizations. Media blogger Dan Kennedy says it's no BBC World Service yet.
They've put together a worldwide network of correspondents, but there are very few people out there for whom Global Post is their main job. These are essentially freelancers. Some of them experienced, some of them fairly inexperienced.
But Kennedy says deals like the one with CBS could provide Global Post with the funds it needs to beef up its coverage. Tom Fiedler knows what it's like to stare at a news budget. He used to be the executive editor of the Miami Herald and is now dean of Boston University's College of Communication.
From the standpoint of a news organization that is having to manage its dollars much more closely than ever before, I think this is a huge opportunity for CBS.
A network that once had 24 foreign bureaus and now has just a few. Fiedler calls the Global Post model an encouraging one.
This in some ways brings the benefits of outsourcing, but without some of the problems that sometimes come with that, primarily over quality control.
CBS won't be taking full reports from Global Post at the outset. Instead, it'll take in information and repackage it for broadcast. But if current trends continue, Global Post correspondents might want to find a good hair and makeup team, just in case. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Speaking of international news, the Swiss food giant Nestle is being accused of aiding and abetting the theft of a dairy farm in Zimbabwe. The company has admitted buying milk from a farm run by the wife of President Robert Mugabe, the farm that was taken from its white owners. From the European desk in London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard has more.
Nestle admits that it buys large quantities of milk from the Gushungo dairy estate in Zimbabwe. The property was once known as Foyle Farm before the white owners were forced out and Mugabe's wife Grace took over. The company says it's not broken any law by doing business with the Mugabes. Since it's based in Switzerland, it's not bound by US or European sanctions. But Todd Moss of the Center for Global Development in Washington says Nestle should think again.
The spirit of the sanctions is that particular individuals and firms were actively undermining democracy and contributing toward the destruction of that country. And so that's something that an internationally minded company like Nestle would want to take into account.
Nestle says that Zimbabwe's dairy industry has collapsed. The company's been forced to buy milk where it can. It says if it had pulled out of Zimbabwe, there would have been further food shortages and hundreds of job losses. But some expatriate Zimbabweans are not impressed. Wilf Mabanga edits a magazine for his fellow exiles in England.
Is it morally right for Nestle to be buying milk and paying somebody who is not the owner of the farm, but they're aiding and abetting the stealing of private property?
He says the seizure of almost all of Zimbabwe's white-owned farms ruined the economy. He's now urging his readers to boycott Nestle products to protest against the company's dealings with Grace Mugabe. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, traders rode that merger news we were telling you about to a happy finish. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. If you want to stay up to speed on the healthcare debate, room 216 of the Hart Senate office building in Washington is the place you'll want to be at 9:30 tomorrow morning. The Senate Finance Committee will be getting back to work on its overhaul bill. One of the key features of that bill is something known as an individual mandate, a requirement that everyone has to have health insurance, even if they have to buy it themselves. As with everything in this debate, that idea has its supporters and its opponents. The insurance industry comes down firmly on the supporter side of that requirement. Joel Rose has more from our series, The Cure, Remaking Healthcare.
The Senate Finance Committee's healthcare bill would potentially mean 30 to 40 million new customers for private insurance companies and billions of dollars in new revenues.
This is a bill which I think is in almost every way the insurance company's dreams.
That's Richard Kirsch from Healthcare for America Now, a liberal activist group. He says insurance companies are getting what they wanted the most without giving up much in return. The bill does not include the public option of a government-run insurance plan that would compete with private insurers, and there are no caps on the growth of insurance premiums. California Lieutenant Governor and former Insurance Commissioner John Garamendi says that's a recipe for disaster.
There'll be at least 30 million Americans that'll be thrown into the insurance marketplace, and I'm telling you, the sharks are circling. And those new customers will get eaten alive just the same way as the existing customers of private insurance companies are.
Health insurance premiums have been rising at about 6% a year. If that continues, the nonprofit Kaiser Family Foundation says the average family policy will cost more than $24,000 within 10 years.
I certainly don't agree that it's a gift to the insurance industry.
Edward Hanway is the CEO of Cigna, one of the country's biggest insurance companies. Hanway says the overhaul will require the industry to make its share of sacrifices, too. For instance, it would create new taxes on insurance companies, and they would no longer be able to deny coverage for pre-existing medical conditions, nor would they be allowed to charge more for them.
So no, I don't think we, quote, dodged a bullet. And this is an industry that seriously wants to see reform and wants to be an active partner with people in getting reform done and done the right way.
part of what insurers want, frankly, is survival, because they see that there's desperation to do something about healthcare costs and healthcare cost growth.
Len Nichols is with the New America Foundation, a nonpartisan think tank in Washington. Nichols says insurance companies have realized they'll have to accept more government regulation, and now they're trying to get the best deal they can.
You're much more likely to get cooperation and reasonable accommodation of your most intense concerns if you're in the room.
Insurance companies have been more than just in the room. They have hundreds of lobbyists and have made millions of dollars in campaign contributions. The end result, says California Lieutenant Governor John Garamendi, is a bill that would do little to contain the soaring cost of premiums.
If you don't have an enforcement mechanism, then God help the consumer, because there isn't going to be anybody else out there to help them.
The insurance industry says there are some good cost controls in the Senate Finance Committee bill, but they're mainly geared at hospitals and doctors. There are also new taxes on insurance companies. Cigna CEO Edward Hanway says he'd rather see lawmakers focus on the delivery of care.
Do we have some concern relative to the level of taxation of our industry? We do. We're concerned that ultimately that simply may add cost to the system as opposed to reducing cost. But certainly in terms of the outline of that bill, there's a lot there that we're supportive of.
That's exactly what makes consumer advocates so nervous. I'm Joel Rose for Marketplace.
For more of our series, The Cure, go to our website. It's marketplace.org. We learned in the pages of the Wall Street Journal this morning that the federal government is thinking about getting even more involved in the real estate market. The paper says the White House is putting the finishing touches on a $35 billion shot in the arm for state and local housing programs. Question is, how come? To get the answer, we've called housing economist Nicholas Ritsinas at Harvard University. Mr. Ritsinas, welcome to the program.
Nice to be with you.
What is happening on the state and local level in the housing market that they need $25 or $30 billion?
Well, a number of states, almost every state, has something called a housing finance agency. They've existed in various forms over the last 30 years. Traditionally, they issue bonds, and they use those bonds to buy mortgages for first-time home buyers. What's not happening is states are having a very difficult time selling these bonds, because you might imagine anything with the word housing on it is looked at askance by possible investors.
So here we have Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the Treasury Department also getting further into the housing market, down deeper at the local level.
To put this in context, in the third quarter this year, 90% of all residential mortgages in the United States were touched by the government, either insured, guaranteed, securitized. So this is just one more step where government de facto becomes the housing finance market of the United States.
Well, let me ask you this then. As the government is pulling back on some of its other bailout mechanisms, the Federal Reserve and TARP is being paid back, the government is still very heavily into the housing market, is what you're saying.
Very much so. The Federal Reserve, for example, announced that it's going to continue its purchase of mortgage-backed securities, which they've purchased over $800 billion so far, with a target of over $1.25 trillion. So they're still very much involved. And the question would be, if they weren't involved, what would happen in the housing market?
Well, one thing that might happen is that fewer people would own homes. Is that reasonable?
Fewer people would own homes because credit would be tighter. The interest rate would be higher. Down payment requirements would be higher, all of which would lead to fewer prospective buyers. There are already too few buyers now for a functioning housing market in a country our size. This would further tighten those credit markets.
Maybe you see where I'm going here, though, but wouldn't it be good to tighten up requirements for the housing industry? Isn't this part of how we got into this mess in the first place? Was too many people who ought not be in houses in houses?
That's certainly part of a general orientation. To be candid, though, the housing finance agencies never got swept up into the subprime lending. So ironically, the housing finance agencies really have been among the most prudent of lenders. The odd thing is it's so late in the game. It's a wonder this wasn't done a little earlier on. But at this point, it's just one more step in what is a giant footprint in the housing market.
Well, in percentage terms, as you mentioned earlier, it's not that big a step in. Is it too little too late to do any good?
It is a little late, but if you're a first-time buyer standing on the sidelines deciding whether to buy a house, it may be that added incentive. So it will add a little bit of oomph to the housing market, But the price of that oomph is the government getting even more deeply involved and taking on, again, added risk.
Nicholas Ritsinas, he's the director of the Joint Center for Housing Studies at Harvard University. Mr. Ritsinas, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Coming up, art and the economy.
If we get 10 more rooms than we didn't have before, that's an uptick. And to find upticks in today's economy is very difficult.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials jumped 1.25%. Today, 124 points, closed at 9,789. The NASDAQ bounced 1.9%, 39 points, finished at 2,130. The S&P 500 jumped up 1.75%, 18 points, ended at 1,062. We told you about that Abbott Labs deal. Abbott shares rang up 2.75% today. The news that Xerox is buying affiliated computers sent ACS shares soaring 14%. But investors shredded Xerox today. The company's shares fell 14%. Cisco Systems powered up more than 4% today. Microsoft sparked up more than 1%. Apple rolled up more than 2% today. Bond prices sank. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.28%, and you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing first-hand consumer reviews on local services like plumbers, painters, movers, and now doctors. Details at angieslist.com. Coverage of Asia is supported by the Freeman Foundation. We've got all the business news worth talking about on our new blog. Scott Jagow hosts the Marketplace Scratchpad. You can check in with him throughout the trading day at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee discusses the Obama administration's H1N1 flu vaccine program. A Senate subcommittee on crime and drugs holds a hearing on bodybuilding products and hidden steroids. And the Veterans of Foreign Wars marks its 110th anniversary. The VFW was established on September 29, 1899. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The streets of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania are clearing out this week after the G20 summit that wrapped up this past Friday. In the official communique that came out as that meeting closed, the group gave itself pretty high marks for what it's been able to do to avoid another global financial crisis. That is not, though, a view shared by all, including economist Joseph Stiglitz, a critic of a lot of what globalization has brought to pass. When we spoke, I asked him whether the global economy is any safer now, he thinks, a year into the credit crisis and three G20 meetings later.
Clearly, we've pulled back from the brink. But if you ask me, is our financial system reformed in the way that would make it less likely that another event of this kind could occur, I'd say we're in worse shape.
Do you have hopes that we'll eventually get someplace where we can fix it?
I think we're going to make some reforms, but I'm getting increasingly pessimistic. I mean, let me go back to why I think things are in worse shape. We had some banks that were too big to fail. What we've done is allowed the banks to get even bigger. Under both administrations, it's introduced a new concept called too big to be resolved. We bailed out the bankers. We bailed out the bondholders. This old problem of moral hazard, perverse incentives, has gotten just much worse.
Separate the financial crisis from the economic crisis for me for a second, and give me your thoughts on the recession, how we're coming out of it, if you think we are, and how much longer that might take.
The distinction you draw is really an important one. You know, the collapse of Lehman Brothers, the financial crisis, was a consequence of a set of economic problems we would have had to face in one way or another. Even when we fix our banking system, we don't want to go back. We shouldn't want to go back to that world. Savings rates are going to go up. They've already gone up to around 5, 6, 7%. While that's good for the average American's personal security, the fact is that if people aren't spending, there will be a lack of aggregate demand. The economy will be weak. The question is, what's going to fill in that hole? And no one's put forward, on the part of the government, an alternative source of long-term sustainable growth.
Seems to me, on the one hand, you're condemning the government for its massive intervention a year ago, but now you want the government to provide some kind of mechanism for growth and stimulating demand now.
The distinction is, we need money for real spending that leads to an increase in aggregate demand, not throwing money at the banks that didn't lead to more lending, didn't lead to a strengthening of our economy. It was certainly not something to put us on a course of sustainable, robust growth.
So despite what Fed Chairman Bernanke said the other day about the recession being technically over, you're not on board with that one?
The key word here is technically. Yeah. Economists say the recession is technically over when growth turns positive. But for most Americans, what they mean by recession is, are there jobs? And the basic arithmetic here doesn't look very good. And we're not even talking here about lags. The administration and Fed talk about, you know, jobs always lag recovery. This is just not a robust enough recovery to generate the jobs with or without lags.
I wanted to ask you about that traditional measurement of economic growth, gross domestic product. You came out with a report a couple of weeks ago now saying what we really need to do when we measure GDP is not just look at factories and production and sales and all that stuff. We need to think about sustainability and personal satisfaction and things like that. It's not the first time that argument's been raised, but why do you think that's necessary?
Well, this crisis sort of in a way illustrates that. Many people looking at the U.S. economy in the years before the crisis looked at our GDP, said we were doing great. But the way we value output is to use market prices. An important part of output was real estate, but that was all based on bubble prices. Our growth was based on debt, and it was a kind of borrowing, not for investment, but for consumption, and that's just not sustainable.
Joseph Stiglitz from Columbia University. He's got a new book coming out, not till the spring, though. It's called Free Fall. Professor Stiglitz, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you for talking to me.
Grand Rapids, Michigan is just one of the many Rust Belt towns that's trying to remake itself by moving away from its traditional industrial economy. Grand Rapids has been investing in medical research facilities to do that. It's also hoping to put itself on the map as a magnet for artistic innovation. Over the next 2 weeks, more than 1,200 artists from around the world are going to be in town. Their work will be in the streets, it'll be on buildings, even in the middle of the river downtown, competing for a $250,000 grand prize. From Michigan Radio, Dustin Dwyer has our story.
The competition is called Art Prize, and on opening night, downtown Grand Rapids was hopping.
Dad, let's go down there and get further.
You want to get further down there?
Yeah.
No, ma'am.
People gathered on a pedestrian bridge over the Grand River. Below, an 80-foot styrofoam sculpture of the Loch Ness Monster rose from the rushing water that gives the city its name. Above, a brightly painted set of table and chairs, 30 feet tall, sat atop the bridge. Part of what makes Art Prize unique is that the art is not stuck in a museum or gallery. Projects are on display in nearly 160 locations around downtown. That includes office buildings, sidewalks, a dry cleaner, and a whole lot of restaurants. The idea for Art Prize came from Rick DeVos. His grandfather co-founded Amway, the direct sales company based in nearby Ada. His family fortune is covering the prize money for the competition. On opening night, DeVos had a lot of sponsors to thank for picking up the event's operating costs.
I know that a lot of you did not know what you were funding or why you were supporting us back in April when we called you then, but what a great city this is where more than 60 business leaders will back an idea and a dream.
But those business leaders are hoping to get something out of the deal too.
I think it's about 100 times busier than a normal Wednesday.
Greg Gilmore watches the crowd at a four-story complex of restaurants and clubs he co-owns downtown. It's hosting more than 150 art projects.
We've seen traffic for the week during setup. We've seen a lot of traffic in the last several days prior to opening. And I think in the long run, it's just going to be very large.
There are no official estimates of how many spectators Art Prize is expected to draw or how much spending it'll generate, though by Friday, 15,000 people had already signed up to vote on the art. Gilmore says not everyone who stops by is eating at his restaurants, but he still expects a 30 to 40% jump in business. Hotels are also hoping to get a bump. Doug Small is head of the Grand Rapids Convention and Visitors Bureau. He says so far there's been a slight increase in the number of hotel stays because of the competition.
Listen, if we get 10 more rooms than we didn't have before, that's an uptick. And to find upticks in today's economy is very difficult.
But a small uptick in hotel stays or an increase in restaurant sales won't do much to turn around the city's unemployment rate of 12%. Many people in town wonder what the competition can do over the long term to change the city's image and spur growth. And on that front, Art Prize is already generating some buzz.
I was kind of blown away by it.
Richard Florida is a leading thinker in urban economic development. He wrote a book called The Rise of the Creative Class, which has influenced how many planners and politicians think about cities. The main idea is that cities need to become hip, creative places if they want to attract talented workers. Florida says Art Prize could put Grand Rapids on the map.
For most people looking in at Grand Rapids, you would think, you know, why didn't this happen in Brooklyn? Why didn't this happen in Williamsburg? Why did this happen, you know, in the San Francisco Bay Area?
Florida says if Art Prize works in Grand Rapids, it could be a model for other not-so-cool cities that want to get noticed. But he warns that it'll take more than a three-week competition to transform the city. Art Prize will be back next year, but Florida says for Grand Rapids to truly transform, the work will have to continue for decades. I'm Dustin Dwyer for Marketplace.
You can check out a virtual Art Prize competition on our website. We've got pictures of some of the entries there online at marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today, more trouble for Acorn, the community organizing group. Congress and some other federal agencies have already yanked Acorn's funding. Today, Bank of America said it's not going to work with the group anymore either. Friday afternoon, some congressional Republicans asked B of A and 13 other finance companies about their dealings with Acorn. It's been a couple of weeks now since videotape of Acorn workers giving advice on how to break the law hit the streets and, more importantly, hit the web as well. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Monday afternoon. Today, the Dow rose 124 points, 1.25%, closed at 9,789. The NASDAQ was up 1.9%, 39 points, 2130 the number. The S&P 500 rose 1.75%, 18 points, ended at 1,062. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Coming up next time on the broadcast, businesses are trying real hard to get new consumers, even the poor ones.
Manufacturers, processors, retailers, they don't want to readily concede a market or say we're not going there.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.